Welcome back to the podcast. I have the real pleasure today to talk to the author of Too Big to Fail, How the GOP Betrayed the Reagan Revolution to Win Elections, in then parentheses, and how it can reclaim its conservative roots. The author is Matt Lewis. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm good. You said too big to fail, I think. It's too dumb to fail. That's okay.
Too dumb to fail.
Yeah, and you obviously, the name harkens to the Too Big to Fail movie and book. And for similar reasons, you got these perverse incentives where, actors and too big to fail, it was financial institutions. In my book, Too Dumb to Fail, it's politicians and pundits who have perverse incentives, to do selfish things that collectively hurt everybody else.
Right. And how provocative the name is, I think, is the very reason why I transcribed it incorrectly. It's such a provocative thesis and such an interesting book. Most of the guests that we have on are sitting in their academic office and occasionally get interrupted by a student. This is not the case for you today. I wonder if you could very briefly tell us where you are professionally, but more importantly, where you are literally today, because it's sort of a significant political day.
Oh, it is. So it is primary day in New Hampshire. I am in my hotel room right now in Nashua, but I was just down in Manchester I did three spots today for CNN. Went to a Ted Cruz briefly. Went to a Ted Cruz rally in Manchester, and this is where the action is. You know, if you're into politics, this is kind of our Super Bowl after the real Super Bowl. And it's been an exciting time for me because my book came out, just a couple weeks ago. And then, with the primaries. And then the other thing is, of course, who would have thought that Donald, when I started writing my book, I didn't even know that Donald Trump would end up being the front runner, and probably, as we talk, likely the winner in New Hampshire. So, it's just been kind of a whirlwind since the book came out.
Right. And this is going to run, 10 days from now. So who knows what will be happening then. But your book isn't just about the here and now. It's also about history. And there's a lot of history in it. Let's start at the start of the book with a question. What is the dirty little secret of the conservative movement that you refer to right at the start of the book? What is this dirty little secret?
Well, I think the dirty little secret is that it's gotten dumbed down over the years. And anybody who watches cable news or listens to Donald Trump speak, I think we'll get a sense of the dumbing down. Just last night, as we tape this, just last night, Donald Trump said a vulgar word at a huge rally. And MSNBC today actually, they warned everybody first, and they actually said it. So it's the dumbing down of politics. I also think it's the coarsening of our political rhetoric is part of the story. But what I do in the book is actually establish that, in fact, conservatism began as a very thoughtful intellectual philosophy, and that over the years it has gotten dumbed down. And my goal with the book is to, in a way, look backward to restore conservatism as a thoughtful philosophy, but also look forward and to have it adapt to the 21st century. And went over people who don't even know that they're conservatives yet.
Now, you highlight the contributions of some of the real luminaries in the conservative world, Burke and Hayek and Friedman. But I wanted you to talk just a little bit about a lesser known conservative, which is Russell Kirk. So who was Russell Kirk, and what was his contribution to conservatism?
And there's actually a book, I'd hate to promote somebody else's book, but there is a book out right now. about mm-hmm. Russell Kirk. And I actually I have my own little podcast, and I had the author on to talk about it. But Russell Kirk was an interesting cat. He was a Michigan professor who at a very young age, relatively speaking, wrote this incredibly influential book called The Conservative Mind that became a huge seller. Really surprisingly, because this is a tome. I mean, this book is very deep and very intellectual, and it looks at all, it looks at Edmund Burke, it looks at, John Quincy Adams and John C. Calhoun, and even so, you know, T.S. Eliot, even poet. So it's not just political figures; it's cultural and artistic figures. And this book was really important, and I think primarily because Kirk helped conservatives decide that they were called conservatives, because there was a real argument, like, what do we call ourselves? Do we call ourselves old Whigs? There was a real fight over whether or not conservative was the right word. But I think the most important thing was that Russell Kirk helped reintroduce a lot of Americans and conservatives to Edmund Burke, who I think is generally thought of as the founder of modern day conservatism. And that was really incredibly important, because Edmund Burke, who his famous writing was Reflections on the Revolution in France. And interestingly, much of what Edmund Burke had to say about, you know, the problems of the French Revolution were really almost a template to describe the problems with communism and the Soviet Union. And so in a way, Russell Kirk imported the ideas of Edmund Burke, and they were almost as relevant in the 20th century as they had been when Burke wrote them during the French Revolution.
Now, this time period you're talking about, up through the 1950s and 60s, was dominated by big ideas and intellectuals. But what most people associate with the conservative movement is Ronald Reagan. And I think what most people who don't know a lot about Reagan would assume or sort of understand that he had some level of hostility towards intellectuals and intellectual and ideas. Is this true? To what extent is this part of the myth of Reagan? To what extent is it part of the Reagan strategy? How do you place Reagan into this story that you're telling about the changing role of ideas in the conservative movement?
So, you know, one of the unique things about this book, maybe not unique, but somewhat unique things about this book, is that I actually am a conservative. And so when I write, a lot of the people who have written these books about the problems of the Republican Party are actually liberals. And so their recipe is for conservatives or for Republicans to fix the movement, their recipe is to become more liberal. And they have right. to go back 70 or 80 years to find a Republican that they like. And I actually see the Reagan years as kind of the high point, where you had a really good marriage between being intellectual and poetic, and yet being populist enough to win a majority, a landslide election, and two landslide elections. Having said that, I think Reagan was a fascinating figure because he really combined a sort of outsider, anti-establishment populist thing with a cosmopolitan elite thing. And, Reagan ran as an outsider, but when he got elected, you know, he went to Kay Graham's house, the mm-hmm. doyen of the Washington Post. And Reagan, of course, you know, sort of was from Dixon, Illinois, and had toured General Electric factories, and he had that populist side to him. But we got to remember Reagan was also a guy who lived in Southern California, had friends who were, you know, movie stars and gays and starlets and all sorts of diverse and disparate Americans. And so I think Reagan really combined those things. And Reagan, I think, was actually much more learned, much more intelligent than he got credit for. It turns out he actually intentionally downplayed his intelligence. As George W. Bush later said, he wanted to be, quote, misunderestimated. Reagan mm-hmm. had his own version of that, and he wanted to be seen as the guy clearing brush at the Western White House and the guy who only read Louis L'Amour, cowboy westerns. That really was a facade. Reagan was much more intellectually curious and smart, but he was so smart that he intentionally cultivated this kind of everyman persona, which I think really served him well politically. But in the book, I argue, it might have had an unintended consequence of helping reinforce the stereotype that Republicans are the stupid party.
Yeah, and if I'm reading your book right, that this what had been a facade became a real hallmark and became a real political strategy. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the role of the map in the role of ideas in conservatism and Republican Party politics in general, and how the southern tilt of the Republican Party explains some of the rise of anti-intellectualism and how that interacts with the thesis of your book.
Right. So my theory is that eventually a movement can start out being intellectual and philosophical. But if you want to win elections, you have to be a big tent and you have to build a coalition. And there's a real tension here between having a big enough tent to win elections and sort of preserving your artistic integrity and intellectual honesty. This is like anybody, like if a rock band, goes mainstream and sells out, this is sort of a common lament of anybody who wants to make it big. And so we've all heard of this Southern strategy and how Republicans wooed Southerners. And, some people suggest that there was, racial dog whistles and all sorts of unseemly and pernicious things involved. But really, to me, the relevant part about this is that when Southerners became, Southerners had been, of course, a big part of the Democratic coalition for years. It's really a wholly owned subsidiary of the Democratic Party. And when they became part of the Republican Party, they brought some good things with them, including the fact that they had numbers and Republicans really started winning national elections. The downside, though, I think, one of the downsides was that they brought with them this strain of anti-intellectualism. And I have a chapter on the South and I have a chapter on evangelicals. I actually am an evangelical. And again, I think that these groups that joined the Republican coalition, they brought a lot of good things with them, and they actually ushered in an era of conservatism. But the downside, I think, is that they brought some baggage with them, including some anti-intellectual, an anti-intellectual strain into conservatism that had not been there before.
One of the things that you write about in the book is the role of technology. And the changing role of technology and how this relates to much of the story you've just told. So how has technology created what you refer to as the instant expert and contributed to how we view ideas? It seems like both within the sort of conservative parts of the country, but also really in a larger way. Tell us about the role of technology.
Well, I think that going back in history, every technological innovation has been a double-edged sword. And I believe that, whatever it is, whether it's, the gun, inventing a gun, right? A gun can keep you safe and a gun can kill people and do great harm. Whatever it is, it seems like there's, it just expands the spectrum of good and evil. And when it comes to communications technology, it does seem like the downside has always been a dumbing down. So if you go back to, the old days when you had preachers who were writing sermons primarily, mm-hmm. those sermons tended to be more intellectual than the days of tent revival meetings where preachers were getting up and swaying people with emotion and rhetoric. But that was probably much more intellectual than the TV preacher that we have. And so you basically have this dumbing down, simplifying of communications. We get to just think of the distance between Ronald Reagan even saying some of the great speeches he gave where he the Challenger speech where he slipped the surly bonds of earth to touch the face of God. This poetry, this hearkening to poetry. And then you have Donald Trump saying some vulgar things, how far we've come in the wrong direction. And I think that the other thing, too, is, if you want to And by the way, I'm glad to not obsessively talk about just Donald Trump. It's refreshing to get to talk about Russell Kirk and Edmund Burke.
Mm-hmm.
But just to put it like in context with modern times, I mean, Donald Trump, you know, if he had tried 20 years ago to do what he's doing now, I mean, there would have probably been some party bosses in smoke-filled back rooms that would have kept him off of primary ballots. Again, double-edged sword. Not a great thing to have party bosses, but they also keep out some bad actors. If Trump had tried this 20, 25 years ago, he would have been doing it before the age of the rise of really talk radio, before Twitter, before the 24/7 cable news phenomenon. And I don't think that Trump could have caught on without 24/7 cable news, the proliferation of talk radio, and Twitter. These are all things that I like, actually. And, you know, I wouldn't have a job if in the old days with the gatekeepers and the old media would, you know, I came up as a blogger and Twitter's been very good to me. But I think that the Trump phenomenon probably doesn't happen in an era where there are gatekeepers, where there are adults sort of deciding who gets in and who doesn't. And I think that's kind of indicative of it. The last thing I would say is I think just the our cultural changes, you know, the celebritization of politics certainly has impacted it. So really, when you look at what happened to the Republican Party and why we are where we are, why conservatism is where it is, it's really the culmination of so many factors, including the people who came into the coalition, you know, decades ago, as well as cultural changes in America, you know, the anger, the frustration, the economy, a backlash against Barack Obama, as well as the rise of the disintermediation of media and the rise of alternative media outlets and social media. I mean, all of these things, it's almost the perfect storm that gets us to where we are today.
So what to do? I think, as you noted earlier, You are not of the camp that suggests moderation is simply the solution, that conservatives should just be less conservative and all of the problems of today will go away. You offer a different set of recommendations. And as you say, you write these as a conservative. I wonder if one or two of your recommendations stand out as particularly likely to be taken seriously by those with real power. And I don't know, one or two maybe that you made recommendations that you maybe don't expect for there to be as fertile a ground for implementing these changes. So tell us about what you think could change the status quo.
Right. Well, I mean, I go through really the last three chapters of the book are sort of summoning conservatives and Republicans to sort of accept reality, which is the fact that demographically speaking, doubling down on working class, white, older, Southern, rural, married voters is just a bad mathematical strategy. I mean, I'm putting aside the problems that I have with it in terms of policy, but just if you purely Machiavellian, purely strategically, you know, America is becoming more diverse, more urban, more, you know, cosmopolitan. And so right now, I think, is really a crossroads. I mean, the party of Trump is doubling down on the kind of angry working class, white, older, rural voter, not even that conservative, actually. He does very well among, Trump does very well among liberal and moderate Republicans, mm-hmm. who tend to be more secular. That's the interesting thing. He doesn't really appeal to conservatives as well as he does, you know, sort of more moderate or liberal Republicans and even Democrats who tend to not have college degrees. That's a very different party. The party of Trump is incredibly different from like the party of Marco Rubio and Paul Ryan. And those two, I think, are, I don't know what that was, sort of crazy noise out there. Those two, I think, are specifically candidates who could appeal to 21st century Americans who might not even know they're conservative yet. And I always tell the story about the type of person that I think could be a conservative and doesn't know it yet. And if you think of like a young woman who lives in an urban area, who gets, you know, gets on her smartphone and orders an Uber and then goes on StubHub and orders concert tickets, I mean, that young woman should be a conservative. She's not going to like onerous governmental regulation that wants to keep down companies like Uber. She's entrepreneurial. It's hard for me to imagine that she's going to want to trust the federal government to manage her retirement when she's probably managing her stock portfolio on her phone. And I think she could be a conservative if, in her mind, what she associates with conservatism is this optimistic entrepreneurial movement and not a stereotype of a guy who looks like Boss Hogg and rides around with a truck with a Confederate flag in the back of it. So I do think that going into the future, it's certainly possible to portray, you know, a Hillary Clinton style of liberalism as really a 20th century command and control, top down, you know, old fashioned model of organizing ourselves politically. And the conservatism could appeal to, you know, to millennials, urbanites. But again, it really depends on how it's portrayed and the perceptions. And that's a lot of what the book's about.
Yeah. The correct title of the book, Too Dumb to Fail, How the GOP Betrayed the Reagan Revolution to Win Elections and How It Can Reclaim Its Conservative Roots, published by Hachette Books, 2016. Matt Lewis, thank you so much for your time on this very busy day.
Thank you. It was a great conversation, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, much appreciated.